This is Radio Superior 1945, a reproduction of actual news events with authentic popular music from 1945. This is a true story of our past. Step back with us to another time. We bring you now inside the KUWS radio studios and the Martin and McKenna Show.
This is the voice from the head of the Great Lakes station, KUWS. Jack McKenna reminding you to stamp them out and buy U.S. war bonds and stamps. It's 6 o'clock Central Standard Wartime, Wednesday, April 18th, 1945. Lou Martin is standing by with the 6 o'clock news. Harriet has what's playing at the theaters, and Tony Jasmine will be in for the sports with we'll do that paragraph again. Lou Martin is standing by with the 6 o'clock news. Harriet has what's playing at the theaters. Tony Jasmine is in for Ray Paulson. And at the end of the show, we'll have a special report from Edward R. Murrow. What's that about, Lou?
Well, I don't know. Stations here have been told to stand by. It's from a place called Bergen-Belsen.
Never heard of it. The 6 o'clock news is brought to you by Holden Tire and Battery, which has Goodyear extra mileage, tire recapping for just $7 a tire. Holden Tire, phone 4403. Now here's Lou.
Good evening, Jack, and good listeners. The Third Army has crossed into Czechoslovakia. The First Army is in Leipzig. The Battle of Okinawa rages on, and the beloved combat reporter Ernie Pyle has been killed in the Pacific. We begin our shortwave radio world report from the Pacific and Okinawa.
This is the Pacific, Stan Turner in Okinawa. The greatest frontline reporter of this war has been killed in action. Ernie Pyle, the skinny Scripps Howard War correspondent, beloved by U.S. fighting men the world over, was killed by a Japanese machine gun bullet on a little island off Okinawa. Pyle had come close to death countless times, first in North Africa, then Sicily, Italy, and France. Pyle started covering the war in England and North Africa. He stayed with it except for a brief furlough home until the Americans were sweeping the Germans out of France. Then he came home again, leaving the front because he couldn't stand the sight and smell of death any longer. He didn't want to go to war again. He felt he owed it to America's soldiers and sailors and Marines in the Pacific. He landed on Okinawa on what the GIs called Love Day, the day of the first assault. In Washington, Naval Secretary James Forrestal said Pyle was killed instantly by a surprise machine gun attack at 10:15 in the morning. He was observing the advance of the 10th Army troops who had invaded that island Monday. At the time of his death, he was with foot soldiers, the men for whom he had the greatest admiration. Ernie Pyle was a foxhole reporter. What interested him was the GI in the dust and the muck. He was slight, weather-beaten, gray-haired, and balding. He was ill much of the time. He would have turned 45 in August. Once in North Africa, German Stukas were strafing the troops. He dove into a ditch behind a soldier, and when it was over, he said, "Phew, that was close, eh?" The soldier didn't answer. He was dead. Pyle said over and over that he was constantly afraid. Once at Anzio, a bomb knocked him out of his bunk. He reported it, but most of his column that day was about the GIs in that hut with him. In France, Pyle finally saw all the death he could stand. He wrote candidly that he could no longer take it. He had to come home. Soldiers wrote him letters telling him they knew just how he felt, and they didn't blame him for leaving. But Pyle couldn't stay away. He felt the war was just as much about the Joes fighting it, so he went to Okinawa. Everywhere he went, soldiers told him their stories, and he always got their names and addresses right. If he slept on the ground with a bunch of exhausted soldiers, he wrote about that. If they were homesick, hungry, dirty, and grumpy, he wrote about that, too. Pyle's columns about combat troops won them an increase in pay. He wrote that if airmen and others got extra pay for combat, men with rifles should, too. Congress agreed. Pyle didn't know any long words. At any rate, he didn't didn't use them. He would write with great feeling, and it was all genuine. I know. I covered part of the Sicilian and Italian campaigns with Ernie Pyle. His death is a great loss to his wife and family, but also to the G.I. Joes everywhere. News of Pyle's death saddened an already bereaved White House. A few moments after hearing the report, President Truman said, quoting him, "The nation is quickly saddened again by the death of Ernie Pyle. No man in this war had so well told the story of the American fighting man as American fighting men wanted it told. He became the spokesman for the ordinary American in arms, doing extraordinary things. He wrote about a people in arms as people still, a people moving in a determination which did not need pretension," unquote. Pyle is the 30th Allied war correspondent killed in combat. At Okinawa Command, this is Stan Turner. Calling headquarters, come in Frank Tremaine in Guam.
Hello, this is Max Jordan with Patton's Third Army.
Headquarters in Guam, Frank Tremaine here. A sizable chunk of the Nipponese Air Force has been destroyed in the past month over Okinawa. 2,300 Jap planes have been scorched by anti-aircraft fire and carrier planes in support of Okinawa. This staggering toll was announced by Admiral Chester Nimitz today, and increasing speculation that the Nip Air Force is being depleted of pilots and planes. The attack on the carrier task force has been fierce, however. Japanese planes hit the Okinawa area in heavy attacks on Monday, striking in 10 waves between 9 and 10:30 in the morning. 62 were shot down, but 10 were destroyed in suicidal attacks. AP correspondent Vern Hoglund says he spotted several old-style training planes, planes that have not been used since the war began. One Japanese pilot rescued at sea appeared to be a boy of 16. Meanwhile, infantrymen on southern Okinawa were locked in a bitter artillery duel 4 months north of the capital city of Naha.
4 miles.
What did I say?
6 months.
Oh, sorry, with meanwhile. Meanwhile, infantrymen on southern Okinawa were locked in a bitter artillery duel 4 miles north of the capital city of Naha. Other Marines met pockets of resistance near the northern beaches of the island. Finally, Admiral Nimitz has given the last report on the Battle of Iwo Jima, which ended organized resistance a month ago. The little island, 750 miles south of Tokyo, was the bloodiest conquest of the Pacific War. 23,000 Japanese soldiers were killed from D-Day, February 19th, through last Saturday. Less than 500 enemy soldiers were taken alive. American Marines killed were 4,200, for more than 15,000 wounded. In Okinawa, this is Frank Tremaine calling Europe and come in Germany.
Hello, this is Max Jordan with Patton's Third Army. The Third Army bisected Germany today by invading Czechoslovakia. Lieutenant General George S. Patton's Third Army stormed into Czechoslovakia, assuming proportions of the greatest victory of the war. This is even more costly to the Germans than the Russian victory at Stalingrad. Already 309,000 Nazis have been taken prisoner in the Ruhr industrial trap, with another 50,000 expected to be taken today. At Stalingrad, 312,000 Germans were killed or captured. This is the eighth country invaded by General Eisenhower's Allied troops from the west. All along the front, General Eisenhower's troops are gathering for the final drive eastward to meet the Russians. The First Army is less than a mile from the great German city of Leipzig, while the Seventh Army cleared half the Nazi city of Nuremberg. The Ninth Army has captured Magdeburg, securing a firm anchor on the Elbe River outside Berlin. Magdeburg was the 20th largest industrial city in Germany until Allied bombs reduced it to smoking ruins. The 2nd Armored Hell on Wheels and 30th Old Hickory Divisions did the rest of the damage. Final battles continue inside the cities of Halle, Dusseldorf, and the suburbs of Bremen. British troops are within 22 miles of Hamburg. The U.S. 7th Army is 140 miles from Hitler's home at Berchtesgaden. And Canadian troops have captured all of northeastern Holland. With Patton's 3rd Army in Czechoslovakia, this is Max Jordan calling London. Come in, Webb Miller.
This is London calling. Webb Miller, your correspondent. German radio broadcast monitors here declared the battle for eastern approaches of Berlin has reached its climax. Red Army has breached defenses and is just 18 miles from Berlin. Radio reports say the Russians have launched a third offensive south of Stettin in hopes of linking up with Allied armies on the North German plain. Eastern Front dispatches to Moscow assert that Soviet troops can see Berlin burning. German rebel radio Transocean says 9 Russian armies are smashing towards Berlin, conceding enemy gain. Transocean says 2.5 million Soviet troops are attacking Berlin, with 4,000 artillery guns firing 500,000 salvos against the city every 24 hours. Berlin DNB radio is urging Berliners to brace for the bloody struggle to come inside the city. In London, is Webb Miller speaking.
Nazi propagandist Paul Joseph Goebbels called on the German people to throw away all the rules of warfare and use every means available to defend the fatherland. The 5th Army in Italy is reporting spectacular gains after capturing Mount Adone just south of Bologna. The 655-meter-high peak was considered the last main defenses south of Bologna. KUWS Radio News Time is 6:08. Jack McKenna has this message from our sponsor.
Thank you, Lou. And we have good news today from Holden Tire and Battery Service Incorporated in Superior. Phone 4482 if you so desire. Goodyear means tire bonus mileage. For $16.05, plus tax, of course, you can get the best tire in the market. Goodyear, one of the greatest tires ever made, and it can be yours for just $16.05. How about a battery for your car? Get your Goodyear all-weather battery for $7.80. It's nice to be sure when you're driving your car. Trucks need truck tires, too, don't forget. Goodyear air wheels, $20.95 plus tax. Goodyear tires are tailor-made for trucks and cars, and they're the best you can buy. And now for a good price at Holden Tire and Battery Service, Incorporated in Superior. Lou?
There was an incident at the Butler Shipyards over a blood drive. Women registering people at the Mobile Blood Bank wouldn't let 3 ex-servicemen donate blood. Frank Schwab, Prosper LeBlanc, and Keith Kern were denied registration because all 3 had either been wounded or had malaria. Knowing how important it is to give blood these days, the men then insisted a physician be summoned. The doctor okayed the veterans for a blood donation. 2 other people are proof that blood can be given many times without ill effects. W.F. Sedin of Superior has given 26 times, and Manuel Gonzalez of Duluth has given 14 times. Gonzalez's apparently come from a good bloodline.
Gonzalez
apparently comes from a good bloodline. He says his father has given 111 pints of blood. Superior City Council President A.D. Weldon has been reelected to a 3rd stint to head the council. Councilman Dallas Kellogg and Dorothy Banks led the support. The chairman of the town of Pratt has been elected to head the Bayfield County Board. Vic Wallen succeeds S.E. Squires from the town of Kelly. Mr. Squires serves on the state assembly. A superior man was irked by what he called a Frenchman's rehearsing. Lieutenant Cinto Westman was a member of the 66th Division, charged with negotiating a truce at the town of St. Nazarene to evacuate civilians. Lieutenant Westman was being led across a French minefield to meet the Germans when the guide suddenly stopped, unsure of where to step next. In a story published in the Saturday Evening Post, Lieutenant Westman remarked, "This is a fine time to be rehearsing." The guide then uncovered a Tuller mine, which gave him his bearings to continue, Jack.
"This is a fine time to be rehearsing? That's what he said?"
"He's a cool customer."
"Oh, I guess. Thanks, Lou Martin, who never needs rehearsing. Let's check our forecast for this Wednesday, April 18th, 1945. It's going to continue being cold, friends. Expect a hard freeze tonight with a low of 22 degrees. Partly sunny and nippy tomorrow with a high of just 42 degrees. Well, it's music time. Let's kick things off with Ted Weems and his orchestra and Jingle, Jangle, Jingle on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Yippee-yay, there'll be no wedding bells for today. 'Cause I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle.
Jingle, jangle.
As I go riding merrily along.
Jingle, jangle.
And they sing, oh, ain't you glad you're single.
Jingle, jangle.
And that song ain't so very far from wrong.
Jingle, jangle.
Oh, Lily Bell.
Oh, Lily Bell.
Oh, Lily Bell.
Oh, Lily Bell.
Though I may have done some fooling, this is why I never fell. 'Cause I got spurs that jingle, jangle, jingle.
Jingle, jangle.
As I go right merrily along.
Jingle, jangle.
They sing, oh, ain't you glad you're single.
Jingle, jangle.
And that song ain't so very far from wrong.
Jingle, jangle.
Ted Weems and his orchestra and Jingle, Jangle, Jingle on station KUWS. Ladies, you can get extra red points from your butcher. Yes, get 2 red points for each pound of used fat you turn in. Boy, I'm worth something there. So keep saving fats for the fighting front and the home front. Heck, with those extra red points, you may be able... Heck, with those extra red points, you may be able to buy an extra pork chop. And Tony Jasmine, speaking of pork chops, is in next with the sports.
Yeah, say that right so I can say hey right. Speaking of pork chops, Tony Jasmine is next with
the sports. Oh, yeah, okay. And speaking of pork chops, Tony Jasmine is in next with the sports.
Hey!
Pork chop. In a good way, Ray.
Tony.
Oh, shoot. I missed one. Damn it, got it.
Just say pork chop in a good way, Tony.
Pork chop in a good way, Tony. On with the music, then. For all you mothers out there collecting fat, this is Spike Jones and his City Slickers and Interfuhrer's Face on the Martin and McKenna Show.
When the Führer says, "Wie ist der Master Race?" "Wie heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So be heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face. When Herr Goebbels says, "We own the world in space," "Wie heil, heil!" Right in Herr Goebbels' face, when Herr Göring says, "They'll never bomb this place," "Wie heil, heil!" Right in Herr Göring's face. Are we not the Superman? Aryan Führer Superman.
Yeah, we are the Superman.
Super duper Superman.
Is this Nazi land so good? Would you leave it if you could?
Yeah, this Nazi land is good. We would leave it if we could.
We bring the world new order. Heil Hitler's world new order.
Everyone of foreign race will love the Führer's face when we bring to the world disorder.
When the Führer says, "He is the master race," "We heil, heil!" Right in the Führer's face, not to love the Führer is a great disgrace. So we heil, heil! Right in the Führer's face. To love the Führer is a great disgrace, so be heil, heil,
right in the Führer's face.
Go ahead, Jack.
Spike Jones and his City Slickers with...
One more time.
Spike Jones and his City Slickers with Interfuhrer's Face on station KUWS. Say hiya, Mike.
Say it with a big question mark, like, what the hell are you doing here?
Oh, okay. Hi, Mike?
Hey, Jackson.
What's with the brown paper bag?
No, what's with me? How come you're here?
Okay.
And then we'll get into the brown paper bag.
All right. How come you're here? What's you?
Well, the way it looks like is, I think Mr. Porkchop Tony got a headache or something, and he had to blow town, and... our buddy Jake, why, he's, no, that's not Jake. Our buddy Rapid Ray, he's got a bad back, and boy, is he cranky. So, looks like I'm going to be doing the sports. What do you think of that?
Well, we ought to do it from a hospital next time. What's with the brown paper bag?
It's full of old clothes. I brought it for the picture show tonight.
Oh, we've had so many clothes drives. My old clothes are pretty pathetic. Where did you get yours?
Old uniforms, baseball jerseys, football pants, golf shirts, that kind of thing, you know. And kids, they love sports uniforms, so this will be great.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
What better way to spread democracy than through baseball jerseys?
That's my cue, fans of the sporting world. The Chi Sox and Cubbies got off on the right foot today as all 16 American and National League teams jumped out of the starting gate for the 1945 pennant race. Veteran southpaw Thornton Lee picked up the win as the White Sox topped Cleveland 5-2 with a loss saddled on Allie Reynolds. Nothing like opening day, especially when you're 38-year-old Paul Derringer of the Cubs. He scattered 7 hits, outlasting the world champion St. Louis Cardinals 3-2. Or how about the youngster, Yankee rookie, Kaya Haya Moya? Or how about... Or how about the youngster Yankee rookie outfielder Russ Derry? The young Derryster slugged a pair of homers to help top the Red Sox 8-4. Bo Sox manager Joe Cronin played third base, holding down the hot corner in the lost cause. Old-timer Leo DeRocher, who drove in 2 runs coming out of retirement after 2 years, playing like a schoolboy for the Brooklyn Dodgers. 37-year-old Jimmy Fox of Philly ran like one, the ancient legs beating out a bunt for an infield hit. How about that, sports fans? This is the first opening day in quite some time that didn't see 2 Commanders at the ballpark with the passing of President Roosevelt and Baseball Commissioner Kenesaw Mountain Landis. You've got to figure that they've got a seat behind home plate right next to Mr. Doubleday, Jack. This is Mike Simonson sitting in for Tony Jasmine, who's sitting in for Rapid Ray, reminding you that everyone loves a good sport.
And everyone prefers Rapid Ray. Thanks, buddy. It's spring at last.
Hey, I take exception to that.
Well, you're an exception, all right. That's what Glenn Miller is playing and Ray Eberle is singing about on the Martin McKenna Show. Orchestra, Will We Ever Forget It, with the vocals of Ray Eberle and At Last on station KUWS.
Let me introduce entertainment editor Harriet Farrig. Good evening, Harriet.
Take me to the movies tonight.
I'm sorry, wrong my
phone. Take me to the movies tonight, big boy. It'll cost you a bundle, though.
Well, there are some reasonably priced shows out there.
Lou's getting his crowbar out to check his coin purse.
Oh, heaven's sakes, Louis, I mean a bundle of clothing. The Palace Theater is letting people in free if they bring 5 pounds of old clothes. Most desperately needed are infants and children's garments. Coats, jackets, shirts, and work clothes. There are so many refugees, so many people driven from their homes in the war in Europe. I've seen pictures of children wearing nothing but rags. A little ragamuffin needs our help. They also need blankets, sheets, pillowcases, afghans, quilts, and good shoes. Ladies' low-heeled shoes are preferred.
Well, I guess that means you get to keep your spike heels low.
Hilarious. But, Harriet, I don't have any old clothes.
That's right, Harriet. You know Lou's Mr. Fashion Plate.
At least I don't have clothes from when the Titanic went down like you do. At least I don't have clothes from when the Titanic went down like you.
Oh, those old styles always come back, Lou. Frilly sleeves are sure to be the rage after the war.
Now, boys, we'll find a way to get into the movie tonight. I mean, get a load of what's playing. MGM's Blonde Fever with Philip Dorn and Mary Astor.
Ooh-wee, she's a dish.
So is Philip Dorn. The publicity reads, "Find out how to tame the wolf in every man."
Boo!
And see what happens when men reach the dangerous age.
When would that be?
Don't say, just say, when would that be?
When would that be?
I've been waiting for you to reach that age for 15 years.
Why would you want me to be dangerous?
We'll have to have a little talk later on, Lou. Let's round up some old clothes, eh? That special report from Edward R. Murrow is next, folks. That special report from Edward R. Murrow is next, folks. Let's enjoy the ink spots, and into every life, some rain must fall on the Martin and McKenna Show.
Into each life, some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can lose the blues in their hearts, but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each light some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can lose the blues in their hearts, but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Into each and every life, some rain has got to fall, but too much of that stuff has fallen into mine. And into each heart, some tears has got to fall, And I know that someday that sun is bound to shine.
Some folks can lose the blues in their heart.
But when I think of you, another shower starts into each life. Some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
That's brand new from the 1945 hit parade with Ella Fitzgerald and the Ink Spots. Into every life, some rain must fall, and don't we know it here on the Martin and McKenna Show on station KUWS. And we end our show tonight with a special report from CBS.
Stand by as we go to Allied-occupied Germany and a camp named Bergen-Belsen with Edward R. Murrow of the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Permit me to tell you what you would have seen and heard had you been with me on Thursday. It will not be pleasant listening. If you're at lunch, or if you have no appetite to hear what Germans have done, now is a good time to switch off the radio. For I propose to tell you of Buchenwald. It is on a small hill about 4 miles outside Weimar, and it was one of the largest concentration camps in Germany, and it was built to last. As we approached it, we saw about 100 men in civilian clothes, with rifles, advancing in open order across the field. There were a few shots. We stopped to inquire. We're told that some of the prisoners had a couple of SS men cornered in there. We drove on, reached the main gate. The prisoners crowded up behind the wire. We entered. And now let me tell this in the first person, for I was the least important person there, as you shall hear. There surged around me an evil-smelling horror. Men and boys reached out to touch me. They were in rags and the remnants of uniforms. Death had already marked many of them, but they were smiling with their eyes. I looked out over that mass of men to the green fields beyond, where well-fed Germans were plowing. A German, Fritz Kirchheimer, came up and said, "May I show you around the camp? I've been here 10 years. An Englishman stood to attention, saying, "May I introduce myself? Delighted to see you. And can you tell me when some of our blokes will be along?" I told him soon, and asked to see one of the barracks. It happened to be occupied by Czechoslovakians. When I entered, men crowded around, tried to lift me to their shoulders. They were too weak. Many of them could not get out of bed. I was told that this building had once stabled 80 horses. There were 1,200 men in it, 5 to a bunk. The stink was beyond all description. When I reached the center of the barracks, a man came up and said, "You remember me. I am Peter Zenkel, one-time mayor of Prague." I remembered him, but did not recognize him. He asked about Benish and Jan Matherik. I asked how many men had died in that building during the last month. They called the doctor. We inspected his records. There were only names in the little black book, nothing more. Nothing who these men were, what they had done, or hoped. Behind the names of those who had died, there was a cross. I counted them. They totaled 242. 242 out of 1,200 in 1 month. As I walked down to the end of the barracks, there was applause from the men too weak to get out of bed. It sounded like the hand clapping of babies. They were so weak. The doctor's name was Paul Heller. He had been there since 38. As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. Two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only 6. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. B-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. An elderly man standing beside me said, "The children, enemies of the state." I could see their ribs through their thin shirts. The old man said, "I am Professor Charles Richer of the Sorbonne." The children clung to my hands and stared. We crossed to the courtyard. Men kept coming up to speak to me and to touch me. Professors from Poland, doctors from Vienna, men from all Europe. Men from the countries that made America. We went to the hospital. It was full. The doctor told me that 200 had died the day before. I asked the cause of death. He shrugged and said, tuberculosis, starvation, fatigue, and there are many who have no desire to live. It is very difficult. Dr. Heller pulled back the blankets from a man's feet to show me how swollen they were. The man was dead. Most of the patients could not move. As we left the hospital, I drew out a leather billfold, hoping that I had some money which would help those who lived to get home. Professor Richer from the Sorbonne said, I should be careful of my wallet if I were you. You know, there are criminals in this camp, too. A small man tottered up, saying, may I feel the leather, please? You see, I used to make good things of leather in Vienna. Another man said, my name is Walter Röder. For many years, I lived in Joliet. Came back to Germany for a visit, and Hitler grabbed me. I asked to see the kitchen. It was clean. The German in charge had been a communist. Had been at Buchenwald for 9 years. Had a picture of his daughter in Hamburg. Hadn't seen her for almost 12 years. And if I got to Hamburg, would I look her up? He showed me the daily ration. One piece of brown bread about as thick as your thumb. On top of it, a piece of margarine. As big as 3 sticks of chewing gum. That and a little stew was what they received every 24 hours. He had a chart on the wall, very complicated it was. There were little red tabs scattered through it. He said that was to indicate each 10 men who died. He had to account for the rations. And he added, we're very efficient here. We went again into the courtyard. And as we walked, we talked. The two doctors, the Frenchman and the Czech, agreed that about 6,000 had died during March. Kirchenheimer, the German, added that back in the winter of 39, when the Poles began to arrive, without winter clothing, they died at the rate of approximately 900 a day. 5 different men asserted that Buchenwald was the best concentration camp in Germany. They had had some experience of the others. Dr. Heller, the Czech, asked if I would care to see the crematorium. He said it wouldn't be very interesting because the Germans had run out of coke some days ago and had taken to dumping the bodies into a great hole nearby. Professor Riesier said, perhaps I would care to see the small courtyard. I said yes. He turned and told the children to stay behind. As we walked across the square, I noticed that the professor had a hole in his left shoe and a toe sticking out of the right one. He followed my eyes and said, I regret that I am so little presentable, but what can one do? At that point, another Frenchman came up to announce that 3 of his fellow countrymen outside had killed 3 SS men and taken 1 prisoner. We proceeded to the small courtyard. The wall was about 8 feet high. It adjoined what had been a stable or garage. We entered. It was floored with concrete. There were 2 rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. Some of the bodies were terribly bruised, though there seemed to be little flesh to bruise. Some had been shot through the head, but they bled but little. All except 2 were naked. I tried to count them as best I could, and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in 2 neat piles. There was a German trailer, which must have contained another 50, but it wasn't possible to count them. The clothing was piled in a heap against the wall. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald. God alone knows how many men and boys have died there during the last 12 years. Thursday, I was told that there were more than 20,000 in the camp. There had been as many as 60,000. Where are they now? As I left that camp, a Frenchman who used to work for Havas in Paris came up to me and said, you will write something about this, perhaps. And he added, to write about this, you must have been here at least 2 years. And after that, you don't want to write anymore. I pray you to believe what I have said about Buchenwald. I have reported what I saw and heard. but only part of it. For most of it, I have no words. Dead men are plentiful in war, but the living dead, more than 20,000 of them in one camp. And the country round about was pleasing to the eye. And the Germans were well fed and well dressed. American trucks were rolling towards the rear, filled with prisoners. Soon they would be eating American rations, as much for a meal as the men at Buchenwald received in 4 days. If I have offended you by this rather mild account of Buchenwald, I am not in the least sorry. I was there on Thursday, and many men in many tongues blessed the name of Roosevelt. For long years, his name had meant the full measure of their hope. These men, who had kept close company with death for many years, did not know that Mr. Roosevelt would, within hours, join their comrades who had laid their lives on the scales of freedom. Back in 41, Mr. Churchill said to me, with tears in his eyes, "One day the world and history will recognize and acknowledge what it owes to your president." I saw and heard the first installment of that at Buchenwald on Thursday. It came from men from all over Europe. Their faces, with more flesh on them, might have been found anywhere at home. To them, the name Roosevelt was a symbol, the code word, for a lot of guys named Joe, who were somewhere out in the blue, with the armor, heading east. At Buchenwald, they spoke of the president just before he died. If there be a better epitaph, history does not record it.
You've been listening to Radio Superior 1945, an original weekly production by KUWS Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. Radio Superior is produced and written by Mike Simonson. Harriet Fahrig is played by Jennifer Simonson. Other performances by Paul Guggenheimer, Duke Skorich, Tom Martinson, Don Hansen, Joel Anderson, Al Katz, Peter Nordgren, John Munson, John Munsell, Ray Paulson, Don Mason, Kathy Loxo, Joey Laporte, Pat Kelly, Brian Matuzak, Gene Andreese, and Kathy Bergren. All events reported on Radio Superior 1945 are actual accounts from the editions of the Superior Evening Telegram. Join us next week for more Radio Superior. This is your announcer, Mark Snow, speaking. Good night.